This is Free Speech Radio News for Wednesday, August 11, 2004. From KPFK in LA, I'm Aura Bogado. Immigrants' rights groups denounce a new plan by Homeland Security. Two groups file suit against the city of New York demanding permits to protest the Republican National Convention. And violence continues to escalate in Iraq. But first, these headlines.
I'm Nell Abram with the headlines for Free Speech Radio News. A bomb exploded today between two Israeli army checkpoints on a busy transit route outside Jerusalem. It was the first such attack in 6 months. Two Palestinians were killed and 19 people were injured. The Al-Aqsa Martyrs Brigade claimed responsibility and apologized for the Palestinian casualties, saying their target was Israeli soldiers and police. Also today, the European Union announced their second aid package this year to thousands of Palestinians whose homes were demolished during Israeli army incursions into the Gaza Strip last spring. Such attacks continue. Just last night, an Israeli helicopter fired a missile into the Khan Yunis refugee camp, wounding 15 people as gunmen confronted an Israeli force demolishing Palestinian homes near a Jewish settlement. India has repealed its controversial anti-terror legislation. Binu Alex reports from Ahmedabad.
In a step minority Muslims in India have long been waiting for, the Congress government scrapped the Prevention of Terrorism Act, or POTA. The legislation was enacted by the previous right-wing pro-Hindu BJP government, who allegedly misused it against Muslims. In Western India's Gujarat state, all of the 280 arrested under the act are Muslims. Prime Minister Manmohan Singh's government says even though POTA has been repealed, it will not make compromises in the fight against terror. Human rights groups, including Amnesty International, have condemned POTA and said its use contravened basic civil liberties. POTA gave unquestionable power to security forces, broadened the scope of death penalty, and gave prosecuting lawyers more scope to detain and interrogate suspects. From Ahmedabad in India, Binu Alex for Free Speech Radio News.
In the retrial in Germany of the only person to have been found guilty in connection with the 2001 September 11th attacks, evidence from a key al-Qaeda suspect in U.S. custody claims that Moroccan student Munir Modasadik had no knowledge of the plot. Our German correspondent Guy Deegan reports.
The United States Justice Department today faxed summaries of the interrogations of al-Qaeda suspect Ramzi bin al-Shib to the Hamburg court where Munir Modasadik is standing retrial on charges of giving logistical support to the 9/11 hijackers. The court heard statements that bin al-Shib had said that the people in question had no knowledge and were not participants in any facet of the operative plans of 11 September. In March this year, a German appeals court quashed the guilty verdict against Modasadik. It ruled that he was unfairly denied testimony from US-held al-Qaeda suspects, including bin al-Shib. The US government says it will provide evidence, but no witnesses. However, Modasadik's lawyers are calling for the court to throw out the case, arguing that any information gathered by US intelligence services may have been obtained through the use of torture. In Cologne, Germany, I'm Guy Deegan for Free Speech Radio News.
A British appeals court ruled today that authorities there can hold terrorism suspects indefinitely based on evidence obtained through torture. One judge writes that British authorities can't use such evidence if the state procured or connived at the torture, but that they're not barred from using such evidence if it falls into their laps. The UK's High Court rejected an appeal from 8 foreign terror suspects. They say they've been held without charge or trial based on information collected by U.S. officials at camps such as Guantanamo Bay, Cuba, or Bagram Air Base in Afghanistan. The United Nations has accused all armed groups in the Congo's Ituri region of war crimes. Heather Rizvi reports from the UN that they also added that Uganda, Rwanda, and the former Congolese government contributed to the massive abuses.
The 65-page report to the Security Council was released this week by the United Nations Human Rights Commission. The report claims that in the past 2 years, at least 8,000 civilians were killed and more than 500,000 were forced to flee their homes in Congo's Ituri province. The Ituri conflict erupted in 1999 as part of a larger five-nation war in Congo that has killed more than 3 million people mostly through hunger and disease. Ituri, which borders Uganda, is home to about 5 million people from 18 different ethnic groups. The region's natural resources include potentially large reserves of oil and gold mines. The International Criminal Court, which is the world's first permanent tribunal on war crimes and crimes against humanity, has started investigating the killings of civilians in Ituri. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Heather Rizvi at the United Nations.
For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Nell Abram.
Immigrant rights groups denounce the Homeland Security Department's plan to bypass extradition hearings and expediting the deportation of undocumented immigrants found within 100 miles of the border. The plan, which in some cases exempts Mexicans and Canadians, will likely be in effect by the end of the month. And, as Mitch Jezerich reports, the announced change comes just after heightened security alerts and the 9/11 Commission's report that has many policymakers looking at immigration.
By the beginning of September, undocumented immigrants found within the U.S. who have been in the country less than 2 weeks will be immediately deported. Such deportations, known as expedited removals, already take place at airports and at border checkpoints, but the policy change will now include people found 100 miles inland of the border, thus denying them an immigration hearing. Canadians and Mexicans may be exempted if it's their first time caught in the country. Homeland Security Department spokesperson Bill Strasburger.
We do have heightened concerns of who is attempting to make illegal entry into the United States, the fact that we cannot detain everyone who's caught, and often people who are released tend to disappear. Roughly 90% of those persons who receive a notice to appear at a court date in the future never show up.
Strasburger also said that undocumented immigrants who are seeking asylum will have the opportunity to make their case to INS agents. But Isabel Garcia, co-chair of the Arizona group Derechos Humanos, says that expedited removals bypass the judicial process. She says only immigration judges should decide who's eligible for asylum.
Immigration agents are not in any position to be a judge in a few minutes or maybe a few hours on whether the person has a credible fear of persecution. We who have worked in the asylum arena know that it's very difficult for victims to immediately spill their guts on the persecution they have faced in their countries, what they've seen family members suffer. They have no trust. Why should they trust that this information won't get back? And so we're extremely concerned rights are going to be violated constantly.
The decision to implement expedited removals is one of several moves to crack down on illegal immigration by the Homeland Security Department since its creation, often saying it will make the country more secure. But Garcia says that none of the moves dealing with the border would have kept out any of the September 11th attackers.
All of the terrorists would have still been able to come in spite of all of these measures, and so therefore the militarization and the crackdown has been on our communities.
Congressional committees are continuing this week to meet over the 9/11 Commission's recommendations, some of which deal with immigration. House Democrats have created bills that mirror each of the 41 recommendations and are demanding quick action on them. However, according to House Minority Leader Nancy Pelosi, Democrats feel that the Republicans are stalling.
We would like to have some of the measures in the recommendations in place by the third anniversary of the 9/11 tragedy. There's time to do that in the next 3 weeks. And those measures that might take longer, we know can be done by the adjournment of Congress in October.
Still, several groups, from the ACLU to the conservative think tank the Heritage Foundation, have urged Congress not to rush into such reforms as was done with the Patriot Act in 2001. And while immigrant rights groups generally applaud the 9/11 Commission recommendations, they also agree that it's important not to rush into the recommendations. Angela Kelly is the deputy director of the National Immigration Forum.
When lawmakers are rushing to get something done, that they don't do it particularly well, like anybody else. We saw, for example, the creation of the Department of Homeland Security was passed very, very rapidly, and the immigration functions of both enforcement and services were split They're not well coordinated. Enforcement was split yet again. And so there's a real problem in how the Department of Homeland Security handles immigration. And, you know, to me, that speaks to what you get when you, you know, rush to do something as important as creating an entire new department.
Instead, Kelly says she hopes when Congress returns in September that it would take up other major immigration reforms that have already been introduced. Mitch Jezerich, Free Speech Radio News.
After nearly a week of fighting the Mehdi army, U.S. and coalition forces are planning a major attack on the city of Najaf, home to radical Shiite cleric Muqtada al-Sadr. Nearly 60 Iraqis have been killed in al-Sadr strongholds in Iraq in the past 24 hours alone. U.S. forces are using loudspeakers to advise residents to evacuate Najaf, a city of roughly 500,000 people. Suat al-Madawi works with the Iraqi Human Rights Society. She joins us today from Baghdad to talk about the situation in Iraq. Now, it's been a year and 3 months since George Bush announced major combat operations over in Iraq. What's the feeling there on the ground? Is the war truly over?
No, I don't think that. It is 8 months and there is nothing happening. You know what's happening in Al-Fallujah and now in Al-Najaf city. There is many things destroyed there. There is many people killed. He said that the occupation forces will leave this city, but there is nothing happening from that.
And we've certainly heard a lot from the Bush administration about liberation in your country. What steps would be required in order to do that? And do Iraqis truly feel liberated?
No, liberated, it is something so important for us. Before, there is no liberated. Everyone know about that. But after, before 1 year, when the occupation forces come here and George Bush, your president, said we bring to the Iraqi people the liberation. Where is the liberation? Many people killed now in every place, in every city. There is someone killed from the police, from the citizen. There is no security. We need that security. He said liberation. Where is the liberation?
Now, recently it appeared that Muqtada al-Sadr's people were ready to shift gears towards civil works programs in the area. Why then the escalation against Najaf this week?
Muqtada al-Sadr, he said the United States and occupation forces must leave al-Najaf. And he against the occupation forces. So when the occupation forces went to Al-Najaf, they attack with them. In Al-Najaf, the people who lived there, all the people, it is Muslim. And they didn't allow the occupation forces come to this city. They prevent them, didn't allow to them to enter to this city. Especially there is a mosque so important for us.
Suat al-Madawi works with the Iraqi Human Rights Society. She joined us today from Baghdad. You are listening to Free Speech Radio News. Archives of our program are available on the web at fsrn.org. The conflict in the Darfur region of Sudan continues to escalate. The humanitarian crisis of 1.3 million internally displaced people, massive human rights abuses, and attacks on civilians are placing hundreds of thousands of lives at risk. Claims from the government that they will take steps to avert disaster increasingly ring shallow to observers of the crisis. FSRN's Jenny Johnson reports.
The use or not of the term genocide has political implications, as explained by Kristen Wells of Congressman John Conyers' office.
What's the point of using the word? What's the point of having a special word if it's just for the history books? The point should be to use it as a tool to motivate individuals, nation states, to become actively involved in trying to stop the deaths before everyone is dead and it's too late.
The government of Sudan has over time committed to a long series of ceasefire agreements to disarm the Arab militias that are attacking black civilians. In the latest agreement, adopted by the UN Security Council and approved Sunday by the Sudanese government, the situation in Sudan was determined to be a threat to international peace and security and a threat to stability in the region. It called on Sudan to fulfill its previous commitment to facilitate international relief, and it further endorsed the deployment of international monitors and human rights observers. However, also on Sunday, Sudan rejected an African Union proposal to expand its mission there. Human Rights Watch has announced that instead of disarming the government-backed militias known as the Janjaweed, the government has begun to incorporate them into police and other security forces that could be used to secure proposed safe areas for displaced civilians. Omar Ismail of the Darfur Peace and Development Organization sees no difference between the militias and the government and gives compelling reasons why the world should care about Sudan as a failed state. Ismail.
A million square miles is going to turn into a breeding ground for terrorism. The seed is already there in that ground because this is the same government that hosted Osama bin Laden for several years. This is the same government that hosted Omar Abdurrahman, the convicted mastermind behind the bombing of the first World Trade Center in the 90s. That is why people from Vancouver to Kuala Lumpur, from Moscow to Cape Town, should care about what is happening in Sudan today.
Citing the Chad-Cameroon pipeline, Ismail goes on to describe possible regional effects of the conflict in whose interests may be affected.
If the spillover of the problem in Darfur went into Chad and that threw that whole place in a tailspin, then the countries of this whole sub-region of the Sahel are going to be in turmoil. That includes Chad, Central Africa, and Cameroon. Everybody has a stake in this newfound wealth. France's stake at this, and the United States that invested already over $10 billion on that oil.
With indiscriminate attacks on civilians, rapes, forced displacements, acts of violence with an ethnic dimension, and a government that increasingly appears complicit, what is needed, according to observers, is an independent force to restore security.
The AU, the European Union, and the UN are, I think, very quickly going to have to decide whether the people of Darfur are more important than the principle of national sovereignty.
Adetai Akwe, Advocacy Director for Africa at Amnesty International, addresses the response that is needed from the international community.
We basically need a mobilization of humanitarian resources, but also of public outrage that our governments, that the U.S. government, which has done more than we expected, is still not doing enough. The benchmark for success should be saving lives. We shouldn't be talking about 50 to 350,000 people dying. We should be talking about actual troops on the ground, under ideally the AU's mandate, which has been accepted by the Sudanese government in principle, but certainly not to the size and scale that is needed on the ground.
While the Sudanese government is accused of ongoing atrocities, the UN reports that Khartoum is making serious efforts to keep pledges to curb the violence. For Free Speech Radio News, I am Jenny Johnson.
The city of New York has denied permits to protest the upcoming Republican National Convention. Some groups unhappy with the city's lack of conciliation are refusing to comply to the city's demands. Two groups have filed lawsuits and more are expected before the convention later this month. Leanne Caldwell has more from WBAI in New York.
The National Council of Arab Americans and Act Now to Stop War and End Racism, or ANSWER, are two groups filing a lawsuit against New York City for protest restrictions.
To vindicate the rights really of all protesters, all people that are coming to New York City and have the right to assemble and be in Central Park and in particular in the Great Lawn.
Mara Verheiden Hilliard, attorney for the Partnership for Civil Justice and National Lawyers Guild Mass Defense Committee, is representing the two groups.
There is no reason that the police department, that the parks department, that Mayor Bloomberg can give that is a constitutionally permissible reason to be threatening that people may not assemble in Central Park.
NCAA filed for a permit to hold a civil rights march in Central Park on August 28th, the Saturday before the RNC begins, and 41 years to the day of the Great Civil Rights March on Washington of 1963. Elias Rashmawi, national coordinator for NCAA.
We wanted to come collectively, which would have been the first time ever that Arab Americans, Muslims would stand in a collective along with other communities to in fact emphasize their rights, their constitutional rights in this country.
The group filed for a permit for a 75,000-person rally in Central Park. The city told the group recently that the permit was denied because of the frailty of Central Park lawns. Earlier this summer, Central Park held several concerts, including a Dave Matthews concert that hosted about 70,000 people. Rashmai said that the evidence leads, rather, to an attempt to squander the voices of Arab Americans and those who voice civil rights.
The only thing that I can interpret from this situation, given the ideological slant of the current administration, in fact, policies of the United States in general towards or against Arab Americans, Arabs in general, Muslims, that this is part of a larger construct towards us and that it is motivated, in fact, by the marginalization of a given race or the marginalization of a given community.
A backlash against cooperating with the city in protest for the RNC is spreading. The largest organizing group, United for Peace and Justice, plans to hold a large march and rally on August 29th, one day before the start of the RNC. Last month, the group conceded to city demands to hold a rally on the highway on the far west side of Manhattan rather than in Central Park. But yesterday, Leslie Kagan, national coordinator for United for Peace and Justice, said the West Side Highway won't work because of many logistical reasons.
The major issues that have always been with us are, one, the city's planned use of metal barricades to pen people in, the lack of water in that area, the need for free shuttle buses to transport people back from that area to subway stations, and, of course, the much higher cost for a sound system along the West Side Highway.
UFPJ asked the city for monetary help for water, transportation, and a sound system, but the city won't foot the bill. Meanwhile, the city has contributed nearly $7 million to the RNC. UFPJ applied for another permit in Central Park, but hours later, Mayor Michael Bloomberg denied the request. In a written statement, the city said that organizers need to concentrate their efforts on planning and work with the city and stop the theatrics. The activist group Not In Our Name, working with UFPJ, said the city is trying to stifle their speech. Tanya Mayo, national coordinator for Not In Our Name.
Basically, the West Side Highway, for anyone who's not aware of the location, is trapped between the water and a row of trees and a sort of a desolate area. It's a way of basically saying, we don't want people to hear this message, and we want to marginalize this message.
Mayo said Central Park is the place they will rally on August 29th. UFPJ is speaking with lawyers today to decide if litigation is inevitable. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Leanne Caldwell.
The war in Iraq has generated a hot debate about the role of an all-volunteer military, along with calls for reinstating the draft. Some call the current system the poverty draft, as many young men and women join in hopes of getting money for college. But as the war grinds on, military-affiliated youth programs are conducting leadership development and adventure courses for kids as young as 8 that are explicitly not recruitment efforts. Yet when they're old enough, a high percentage of these youths join the military. FSRN's Melinda Tuhus reports from New Haven, Connecticut.
Dion Ross would make any mother proud. He's articulate, respectful, physically and mentally fit, and goal-oriented. Ross, who just turned 18, is headed off to college with a plan to enroll in the Reserve Officer Training Corps, or ROTC, and seek a commission as a naval officer. He's been a member of the Sea Cadets since he was 12 and a leader for the past few years.
It's a positive youth program, and it's an opportunity for youth to experience military life with no obligation. In just about everything that someone could be interested in, we offer. We offer training in a music school, we offer, you know, hand-to-hand combat training, we offer security forces like police officers kind of thing. And we offer so much, and you're not obligated to serve. So it's kind of like you're definitely given the adventure of a lifetime.
The Sea Cadets, affiliated with the U.S. Navy, is just one of a half dozen programs that serve about 60,000 boys, and now girls too, from elementary school through high school. Another organization, the American Cadet Alliance, has been around for almost a century and includes programs affiliated with the Army, the Navy, and the Marines. Funding sources for the programs include the military budget, the Drug Enforcement Agency, and corporate and individual contributions. All adults who work with the youth programs are volunteers, or as Commander Joseph Land likes to say, non-paid professionals. Land is chief of staff of the American Cadet Alliance and a 10-year Navy veteran who was a cadet himself 30 years ago. He says the mission of all the groups is the same.
To instill an awareness of the importance of being an American and to give young people an opportunity to learn leadership, to test their own personal mettle, to have fun, to make friends, to travel to places perhaps they would not have an opportunity to under other circumstances, and to do all that in a drug-free and crime-free environment.
Cadets learn the core values of honor, courage, and commitment. Adventure is, if not a core value, an important draw for these young people who go to boot camp and participate in rock climbing, scuba diving, urban paintball games, and more. Children as young as 10 also learn to fire guns with live bullets aimed at bullseyes, while youth starting at 13 can participate in a computer simulation program called the Firearms Training System. It's the same system used by the military and police departments around the country. Sea Cadet graduate Dion Ross says the simulated weapons feel realistic.
We use the M60 and the 9mm and a grenade launcher, but it all has the kick. The kick is all realistic and the recoil.
Ross says the most recent scenario he and his comrades were assigned was riot control.
Actually, people were firing at us and we had to fire back. And sometimes they'll tell you, okay, you're going to shoot to kill. Are you going to shoot just to, have them disarm their weapon kind of thing?
Commander Land says his data show that for youth participating in cadet programs for at least 18 months, 60% end up joining the military. But he says no pressure whatsoever is brought to bear, and this was confirmed by some youth participants and their parents from the New Haven area. Arlene Inouye is a teacher in Los Angeles who opposes the growing military presence in the schools, which she says is pushing out other youth leadership and self-esteem programs.
They don't need a hierarchical kind of discipline, which the military is. And the whole system of how it operates is from a top down. You know, you don't discuss, it's not critical thinking, it's you do what you're told. To me, that is not self-discipline.
Although obedience is listed as a key principle on the cadet websites, Commander Joe Land says critical thinking is also a key goal of the programs.
And I think that it's ridiculous to think that, first off, the military lifestyle is all about absolute obedience, because it's not. Now, don't get me wrong, there's times when orders are given in a military environment that are, you know, directed towards time of war, and yes, you carry it out and you salute smartly and say, aye, aye, sir. But, that's adults in a military war environment. We're talking about children here.
For FSRN, I'm Melinda Tuhus in New Haven.
You have been listening to Free Speech Radio News, which is produced at Pacifica Stations WBAI in New York, KPFA in Berkeley, KPFK in LA, and community radio station WMNF in Tampa, Florida. The newscast is produced by Monica Lopez and Simba Russo. Headlines editors are Randy Zimmerman and Nell Abram. DC editor is Mitch Jezerich. Our technical production team includes Jade Paget-Seekins, Pauline Bartolone, Mick Millen, and Lindsay Benedict. We have technical assistance from Eric Klein. For more information or archives of our newscasts, you can visit our website at www.fsrn.org. I'm Aura Bogado.